Hello, this is Kevin Barrett saying, you know, there's not a whole lot of really great stuff on the radio dial these days. That's why you need to support Truth Jihad Radio. Please go to truthjihad.com and subscribe today. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing you amazing guests, telling you all sorts of information that you just aren't going to hear in the corporate-controlled mainstream. And some of my guests are actual true geniuses, and I think that applies to today's guest, Gilad Atzmon. Gilad Atzmon is an amazing musician, an amazing writer, and an amazing philosopher. He covers a lot of ground. His work has focused in recent years on Jewish identity politics. That would be the writing, not the music so much. And it's amazing stuff, and he actually got admitted to the courtroom in Canada where publisher Arthur Topham is being charged with thinking politically incorrect thoughts and putting them down on paper, or at least in electrons. It's a kind of a strange circus they're having over there in Canada, trying to lynch Arthur Topham for looking askance at the orthodox opinions of Jewishness and Jewish identity and things like that. So who better to elucidate the situation and defend Arthur than expert witness on Jewish identity politics, Gilad Atzmon. Gilad, tell me about this trial. What was that about?
Yeah, it's a fast trial. I think that the Canadian media, including the American, the United States media, or international media, kept very quiet about it because they know that it's a fast trial, and they probably realize that with 12 juries, they don't stand a chance to incriminate this beautiful human being.
But wait a minute, the jury is still out.
You're right. They're out. I think that actually out from tomorrow. For probably 24 to 72 hours, but I still don't think that they going to send him to jail. I'm pretty convinced. It would be very, very unusual, especially because I was there. I saw their faces. I spoke to them, and I had an impression that they understand. They understood that. You know, I didn't see them for quite a few days now, for 3-4 days, that this was an inquisitory court, and there was very little truth behind it, if none at all.
Okay, well, you know, from what I've read so far about this trial, it does look like it's going well, and it looks like the defense has kind of taken a leaf out of the pages of the Chicago 7 trial back in 1968. We may recall that the Chicago 7 were a bunch of protesters who'd come to the Chicago Democratic Convention, and they were charged later with conspiracy to create riots. And, of course, all that happened in Chicago was the police rioted and smashed people's heads, and including journalists and delegates. But they had this trial, and the defense used a strategy of being very, very lively and provocative, and actually, you know, kind of using that approach to reveal the sham behind the trial itself. And it looks like something like that's going on here, although not nearly as extreme.
I tell you what happened, and people don't know about it yet. I was allowed to sit in the court and to watch the prosecution, the Crown prime witness, expert witness. His name was Len Rudner. I've never heard about him before. I tried to look on Amazon to find out what book he has written. He didn't write a single book. I don't know what made him into an expert, because he couldn't even answer a single question without looking at the papers, you know. So you have an expert witness sent by the Jewish lobby group that actually was chasing Arthur Topham for years, and the Crown prosecutor, Jennifer Johnston, asked him, Mr. Rodner, can you define anti-Semitism? And he had to read it from the paper. You know, he couldn't well, even...
some expert now, witness.
Now, what is amazing, and this is a story, and actually you are probably the first person to hear about it. Okay, Mr. Rudner wasn't supposed to be the Crown expert witness. The guy who was supposed to be the Crown expert witness was a guy called Bernie Farber. Now, Bernie Farber, when I was asked whether I could come to Canada, the attorney for Arthur Topham sent me a letter, forwarded a letter to me, with the documentation provided by Bernie Farber. Now, this is an amazing story, and you are the first person to hear about it. There is a good reason to believe that there was an act of perjury here on the part of Len Rodner. However, I looked at this documentation, just out of interest. And what happened is that when Bernie Farber heard that I was coming to Canada, he decided not to come. I don't know actually what was the reason for him not to come. He decided that he didn't want to attend the court, and his deputy was sent to the court. The deputy was Len Rodner. Now, what happened in Canada, when I read Len Rodner documentation, it felt very familiar to me. When I looked at it closely, I realized that the documents provided by Bernie Farber and Len Rodner were identical. So it means that the expert documents were not written by any of them, definitely not by one of them. What happened later?
Is that legal?
It's not clear whether this is legal. Barclay Johnson, the attorney for Arthur, showed it to the judge, and the judge was actually more than concerned. What happened that at the time of the questioning, Len Rodner asked whether he wrote the document, and he said something vague like, to the best of my knowledge, I wrote this document. Now, we have definitely a reason to believe that he wasn't telling the truth. Now, this is something very funny. When Bernie Farber sent the documents, the word documents to the Crown, he forgot to turn off the highlight edits on his word documents. And as it seems, when I opened it and looked at it, I actually saw comments from Len Rudner to Bernie Farber and vice versa. So none of them is actually a proper witness. And as it happened, it looks as if Len Rudner was actually not telling the truth under oath. You know, so it will be even.
It sounds like they've got the wrong guy on trial in that court.
I think exactly. It is. I don't think that Arthur is going to jail, but it may be possible that Len Rodner is going to end up behind bars.
Well, maybe you should go testify as an expert witness at his trial, too.
No, but I don't. I can just say, you know, by way of deception is a kosher procedure, as we all know.
There you go. Let's back up for a second, though, and fill in the listeners, because some of the listeners may not really have heard about this trial. It's basically a free speech trial. Arthur Topham publishes Radical Press, which is a very lively piece of, you know, it's amazing stuff. And it's some of it is pretty intense. And it's not afraid of using the J word. You know, it's anti-Zionist, but it also is like you, Gilad. It doesn't shy away from saying things that are pretty hard for the certain elements of the community to bear. And anyways, but they're specifically going after him, I think, for this satire where he just took an actual piece of writing that was what Germany Must Die. And he just substituted Israel for Germany as a way of showing
how ludicrous the text is. So let me tell you exactly what happened there. There are a list of texts that Arthur used. He used quite a strong language, as you say, but definitely he's not an activist, and he definitely doesn't call for violence or incite violence or anything as such. However, what I did, and this is really why I was brought there, you know, it was to present my thesis. And my thesis, you know, as many people know by now, is very simple. If we divide the people who identify themselves as Jews into three categories, those who identify with religion, with Judaism, first category; those who identify with the ethnicity, or even with the race; and third is those who identify with the politics. Now, I argue that people who identify religiously is an innocent category, in spite of the fact that there are more than a few problematic segments in the Bible. And I argue that those who identify ethnically is also an innocent category. The fact that you say I'm a Jew because my mother is a Jew doesn't make you into a war criminal. What I argued is that nowadays there are no people who criticize Jews as a race. I don't say that it didn't happen before. Hitler did. But nowadays, in our era, in our contemporary political discourse, people don't criticize Jews as a race or as a religion. Some people criticize some aspect of Jewish religion, which is totally kosher. People do criticize Jews for their politics and for their ideology. And I argued in the court, and I think that I made my point very clear, to criticize politics and ideology is absolutely okay. The whole idea of politics and ideology is that politics and ideology must be subject to criticism. So I told the court, if Jewish politics is beyond criticism, it means that you in Canada actually confirm that Jews are chosen. If you want to go there, it's fine, but you have to define it in the law. Now, what I did, I took all the arguments that were laid against Arthur. For instance, his usage of symbols, Star of David, the menorah. The menorah is this kind of, you know what is the menorah, yeah? Or is it
Go ahead, tell the listeners what a menorah is.
The menorah is a Jewish symbol, is kind of where you put the candles, and it is something that is associated with the shrine, the Jewish shrine. However, the menorah is also the sign of the Mossad. The Star of David is decorating Israeli airplanes and Israeli tanks.
Right, but we're not allowed to parody or make fun of that, are we?
So I said, as long as the all those Jewish symbols are borrowed by Jewish politics, criticizing them, is more than legitimate, because we criticize their secular political ideological context. We then spoke about the Holocaust. I argued that the Holocaust has been, at least in the eyes of most Jews, has been reduced into a religion. What is the difference between history and religion? History must be subject to scrutiny and revision. Religion isn't. Now, I say, if the Holocaust is religion, it's fine, but at least you have to allow some people to be atheists, you know.
Unbelievers. All right? Heretics.
Yeah, exactly. Heretics. We spoke about this text that you mentioned by Kaufman, German Must Perish. German Must Perish is a horrible text written by a Jew named Kaufman in 1941, or let's say it was published. It's a text that called for the eradication of the German people, and it wasn't an anonymous text, or it wasn't an anonymous writer. The text, the book, as far as I understand, was reviewed by the Washington Post, by the New York Times, and it was actually picked by Adolf Hitler himself as an exemplary case of Jewish animosity. So this text itself is largely responsible for the horrific consequences that occurred to the Jews in these years, or in this chapter, namely the Holocaust.
Well, and this is hardly known at all. I mean, I bet the Holocaust museums, Holocaust education in our schools, never talks about this. And this was, you know, a very big time piece of genocide propaganda targeting Germany that may have backfired and led to Hitler targeting Jews with a lot more venom than he might have otherwise.
For sure, and this is exactly what my argument about in favor of Topham, Arthur Topham Act. What Arthur did, he actually took this text, and as you mentioned, he just changed one word in the text. He changed Germany with Israelis and Nazis with Zionists. And it's really devastating, but it must be clear that Arthur didn't write this document. He made a satire. I looked for the definition of satire. You know, a satire is a way of using humor to show that someone or something is foolish, weak, in order to awaken people to self-reflect. And interestingly enough, in the court, this unwitty Jewish expert, Len Rudner, admitted that the text written by Kaufman in 1942 is a hate speech, an awful speech. And I thought that it's wonderful that it took the Jews 70 years to apologize for this text, but I argue in the court, they only apologized because of the satire that was made by Mr. Topham, which means that he actually achieved exactly what he was there to achieve, to make the Jews, or in this case, Len Rudner, who is a representative of Jewish lobby group, self-reflect.
Wow.
So you know, and I think that the juries understood it. Now, the other thing, there were a lot of texts, you know, all the texts actually that Arthur published, they are all available on Amazon and on the net, and they are legal texts. One of them is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Now, this is a very interesting text, because I don't think that there are many people around who think that this text is really authentic. You know, everybody agrees that the protocols of the Elders of Zion are fictional, or some people say forgery, but this is not the issue.
Right. I still remember, Gilad, the first time I ever met somebody who actually believed they were authentic. That was in like 1998, I think it was.
That's
fairly unusual.
It's fairly unusual. So then you ask yourself, why all those Jewish organizations spend all this energy to convince us that these documents are fictional if we agree that they are fictional? The reason that they do it is because they want to divert the attention from the embarrassing fact that this text is a frightening forecast. When you look at books like the Israeli lobby and the United States Foreign Affairs by Professor Mearsheimer and Walt, two prime professors, you understand that they actually spoke about the fact that the Jewish lobby dominates American policy. When you look at, you probably remember this Yoel Stein article 2008, I think, in LA Time, when he was bragging about Jews running Hollywood.
Right, yeah, Joel Stein, I think it was something like, Jews run Hollywood? Come on.
yeah, you bet, exactly. You know, and then what I brought to the court was a quote by Theodor Herzl that was a contemporaneous of the protocols. He actually affirmed everything the protocol said. This is what Herzl said. I have it in front of me. The wealthy Jews control the world. In their hands lies the fate of government and nation. They set government one against the other. When the wealthy Jews play, the nations and the ruler dance. One way or the other, they get rich. They, the Jews, get rich. Now, this is Theodor Herzl on the
Deutsche. Who needs the Elders of Zion when you've got Theodor Herzl?
He affirmed everything said by the argument, the gist of the argument by the Elders of Zion.
Well, who needs the Elders of Zion when you've got the neoconservatives?
Exactly. Exactly, you know. And I argue, you know, for each argument that Arthur presented, there are way more Jewish radicals, especially Zionists, who would agree with everything Arthur quoted or text he published. Another, a good example, Arthur published a text by Elizabeth Dilling, The Jewish Religion and Its Influence Today, and the purpose of Judaism to exterminate or enslave Christians and the Jewish studies of the Talmud to learn how to undermine Christianity. I just brought some quotes from Ovadia Yosef, who was a chief rabbi, Israeli chief rabbi, and a supreme Talmudist. He died a few years ago. But in 2010, he said, "Goyim," meant Gentile, you people, "were born only to serve us. Without that, they had no place in the world, only to serve the people of Israel." You know, and I'm sure that you heard about this book by Rabbi Shapira called Torat HaMelech, where he gives, 230 pages of instructions for Jews how to kill Goyim. How to kill Gentiles.
Now, wait a minute, Gil. Doesn't this suggest that there may be a problem in the Jewish, not the Jewish religion, but in the way that Jewish religion is interpreted by some rabbis?
I mean, exactly. And this is exactly the thing. You know, I said, rather than dealing with the problem, once again, you try to kill the messenger. You know, so we have a guy like Arthur Topham that celebrates the right that is given to him by law to express his opinions and to make sure that we realize what we are up against, and you take him to court and to try to challenge this right, which is the most precious thing I think we have in the West.
Well, yeah, I can relate to this, Gil. I don't know if you know this, but I was not only denied entry to Canada in May last year, but then I was actually investigated by the hate police in Alberta, not that far from British Columbia, where Arthur's trial was. And they actually sent two members of the hate police squad in Edmonton to my talk. And, you know, they were in plain clothes, so I didn't know they were cops. So I gave my talk, and then afterwards they introduced themselves, told me they were from the hate police, and said that they hadn't found any problems with my talk, and thanked me and left. But I was kind of stunned. Like, since when you're giving a political talk, do you expect the hate police to show up and pass judgment on whether what you said was legal or not?
Yeah, no, I think that exactly what we are dealing here is very, very easy to explain. As you know, I argue in The Wandering Good that when it comes to Jewish politics, rather than post-traumatic stress, what we really encounter is pre-traumatic stress, which I think that is a unique Jewish symptom. They are always tormented by an imaginary fear. Now, what we see in
Canada...
They're
going to drive us into the sea.
Yeah, exactly. What we see, you know, in the book I mentioned this all the Jewish telegram, get worry details to follow. You know, now in the case of the Jewish lobby in Canada and many other places, part of their domination that they've managed to turn the entire legal system and the law enforcement organization to follow this idea of pre-traumatic stress. You know, they are reacting to imaginary fear that cannot even be substantiated.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me stop you for a second there, Gilad, because, you know, it's only a few days now after the sad passing away of René Girard, one of the greatest intellectuals of our time. Yeah. And his work, I think, can help us understand why there's this paranoia among Jews, especially, but maybe some other groups to some extent. But, you know, Jews really have monopolized the kind of victimology associated with scapegoating and human sacrifice, which is what Girard talks about. You know, Girard says that all human societies are based on scapegoating and human sacrifice, and there's this long history of this. And it does seem that the Jewish community in modern times, having been scapegoated and sacrificed, in a sense, by Christians at various points through history, and I'm not saying it was one-sided, of course, has this kind of complex that's become, you know, kind of monumental and oversized. But that doesn't mean that the, you know, there isn't a deep issue here. Like, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. And just because the Jewish community is paranoid about being scapegoated and sacrificed doesn't mean that we don't have this problem in humanity of scapegoating and sacrificing the other. And Jews have kind of played that role disproportionately, and now they're playing it to the hilt, and I would even say to some extent profiting from it. But it's still a real issue, isn't it?
This is a very serious question, because I argue, and actually I borrow this thought, and you know, when I borrow something, I never give it back, you know. So when I borrow a thought, you know, I treat it as if it's mine. But I actually would admit that I borrowed it from Heidegger and Lyotard, that history that presents itself as an attempt to narrate the past, in practice doing the opposite. It's actually it's an institutional attempt to conceal the shame. Now, how is it relevant to the idea that you just explored? When it comes to Jewish history, the one thing that they are really, really good at doing is concealing always the reasoning that led to Jewish persecution. Yeah, so Jewish history is a unique zigzag, kosher zigzag, where the goyim are always at fault, and the Jews are always victims. So when it comes, for instance, to the Holocaust, yeah, we eliminate the case of the Jewish boycott. We eliminate the role of German Jewish elite in the betrayal of a German state and the Balfour Declaration. Mm-hmm. We eliminate all those stories.
We forget about Kaufmann's Germany Must Perish.
And we forget about Kaufmann's Germany Must Perish. We forget about Kuhn changing sides from being pro-German into pro-Brits America and the Balfour Declaration. We forget a lot of things. And then we are left with the horrid story of the Germans completely out of the blue turning against their Jewish brothers. Actually, Friedman gave a very good talk about it in 1961. You probably are aware of this lecture.
Remind me about it.
Let me look. In 1961, a Jew called Friedman.
Benjamin Friedman.
Benjamin Friedman.
Right, right.
Gave a talk, and he actually explore all those issues that the Germans had with the Jews, and those issues somehow never made it into a single Holocaust text or Jewish history book.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? And instead, we've got Hitler's willing executioners by that Daniel, what's his name, who says
Goldhagen.
Goldhagen. Yeah, he makes it into this. You know, he really stresses the fact that they just hate us because that's what they do. There was nothing that we did that had anything to do with this.
Goldhagen is the classic case of a Jewish morbid history, which is not an history; it's a concealment of the shame, and the shame is the fact that, I speak as a Jew, we, the Jews, bring disasters on ourselves. Now, by the way, concealment of shame is not a Jewish procedure. This is everybody engage in shame concealment. For instance, when it comes to American or British history, when you go to Holocaust museums, you wouldn't find any information about the fact that it was actually America that stopped Jews immigrating to America or to Britain from the early 30s. They basically closed the gates to Jewish refugees. You won't find in American history books a lot of information about the industrial homicidal attempt against the German people. You know, America started to develop the philosophy of carpet bombardment from the late 1920s. These airplanes, the B-17, the B-29, they didn't just appear, you know, in 42. These are airplanes. This is strategy that aimed at the annihilation of civilian population that developed in the late 10 years or 15 years before the war. You won't find a lot of information about it in American history books, and this is exactly the philosophy that led to Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
If Holocaust means a fiery, sacrifice, a fiery death, I mean, Dresden and Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Hamburg would be better examples.
So how America and Britain deal with it? Instead of looking into this shameful chapter, they adopted the Holocaust as their narrative. You know, here in Britain, when I came to Britain, there used to be an incredible museum here, you know, the British Imperial War Museum. It was an incredible museum. Now, this museum, like three-quarters of it, is the Holocaust Museum. They left kind of a few exhibits from World War One, World War Two, another, rover jeep from, post-World War Two conflict. And the rest is Holocaust Museum, and the Holocaust has nothing to do with British Imperial Museum. What they basically did, they said, listen, we don't know how to handle this past, so let's hide behind the Holocaust, and it's convenient, it's the Germans, and so on and so on.
You know, it's really creeping everywhere. The Holocaust has colonized Western culture in the last few decades, and I'm here in Morocco right now, where they have satellite TV, and I just caught a few little bit of this Tarantino movie, Inglourious Basterds, which is basically this extremely over-the-top, violent sort of Jewish revenge fantasy of blowing away Nazis. And I bet you wrote something about that.
About the film. For sure. I actually thought that it was a brilliant film. Actually, I think that Tarantino is a genius guy, because, as I said, history is the ability to revise, yeah? Right. And what does it mean to revise? It means that we look at the past as we move along. For instance, as you probably know, you are more or less my age, the word Nakba. It's quite new. We never heard about the Nakba before 87, 88, 89. But the Nakba happened in 48. So what happened between 48 and 85 or 86? Nobody spoke about it. Even Palestinians, diaspora, didn't refer to it. What really happened is that in the 80s, in the light of the ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, some Israeli historians like Ilan Pape and Benny Morris and a few Palestinian historians like Nurma Salha realized that what happened in Palestine was also ethnic cleansing. So we had to wait for the notion of ethnic cleansing to appear in our language in order to understand that what happened in Palestine 30 or 40 years earlier was exactly the same thing. Now, when it comes, and this is, by the way, exactly what history should be, as we move forward, we look back at our past and we understand it, I don't say better, but in a very different manner. Now, what is interesting here is that as we drift away from World War II and we become more and more familiar with Israeli brutality, with the vindictive nature of Jewish nationalism, Sabra and Shatila, and all those genocide and Deir Yassin, and we allow ourselves to talk about it, and then we have Operation Castlet and so on and so on and so on, which is a complete, bloodthirsty genocidal inclination coming into play. We managed to create a Hollywood film where Jews actually celebrate these tendencies, in a fictional film, and this is exactly what the Glorious Bastards are.
And it sort of reveals what's going on, doesn't it? It kind of, reveals that this Holocaust mythology, it's not really about making us better people by saying never again will we mistreat another people. It's very different. It's actually, what it's doing is it's allowing us to unleash our own violence and scapegoating. And that's basically the Holocaust religion is there not only to excuse the Zionist genocide against Palestine, but also to excuse the American wars, because this Holocaust mythology makes us feel like we're the good guys. So we can just go and blow people away because they deserve it. Those Nazis sure deserved it, and so do all our other enemies. So that's what Tarantino is revealing here.
Yeah, but I think that I believe I may be wrong. You know, I'm not the last time I had beer. No, actually, I never had beer with Tarantino. You know, we are not friends. So I don't know. I cannot say what he had in his mind. I definitely know that his producers,
making money from the places.
His producers are what is their name? They are two Jewish Zionist guys.
That helps, Gilad. That could be about everybody in Hollywood.
But I was very surprised that they actually allowed him to go that far and to present the Jew in this film as a merciless, vindictive, bloodthirsty character. It is very, very interesting.
Well, I'm sure that there are sort of layers of protective irony here.
For sure. So we know that it is fiction, but I think that we can get away with such a depiction because this is metaphorically or satirically or allegorically reference to the way we see the Jews now. We have 60 years from the event. I don't think that in 1949 or 1951 people could look at the Jews in America or in Europe in such a manner. By the way, it's quite interesting because as we know now, and this is something that we didn't know in 49 or 50 or 51, as we know now, the Jews in Palestine were already very, very, very brutal towards the Palestinians who had nothing to do with the persecution of Jews in Europe.
Wait a minute. I thought that Bibi Netanyahu told us that it was actually the Palestinians that were behind the Holocaust.
How could they make that mistake? You know, by the way, I enjoyed so much Bibi's comment on the Mufti. I'm sure that you know that Benjamin Netanyahu, his father, was an historian. And not only was an historian, Ben Sion Netanyahu, he was probably the best historian of Zionism. Now, I read Ben Sion, and I really enjoyed his writing. The way he writes, he doesn't write kind of a boring historical text saturated with dates. He has an agenda. He tried to prove something. And if he needs, he kind of fiddle a bit with the fact in order to make a good story. This is what good historians do. Their job is to make history into a beautiful, compelling narrative. And
you can go too far with that, though. Like Philip Zelikow's 9/11 Commission report.
No, for sure. Now, what Benjamin Netanyahu did with the Mufti is a great story. It's a great story because there is no doubt that the Mufti was there in 1941 with Adolf Hitler to tell him, listen, you know, all this pressure on the Jews, you make sure that they don't come to us.
Right. You do anything you want with them, Adolf. Just don't send any more here.
You know, we have a problem. And now I read another... my God, I'm becoming senile now. Another interesting book about World War II at the moment. And the truth of the matter is that some Germans at the time actually started to realize that pushing Jews to Palestine is not good for the Arabs, and they were actually concerned with it. They said, listen, we cannot do it to the Palestinians. The fact, this is quite shocking what I'm going to tell you now, the fact that Hitler meets the Mufti in 41, you know, in 41 Germany is doing very well on all fronts. He meets the Mufti, someone whom the Jews at least would admit to be Semitic, proves that Hitler wasn't an anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. He wasn't an anti-Semite. He just had a problem with the Jews. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the Semitic. It wasn't the racial thing.
And that's kind of strange because, I mean, as I recall, Mein Kampf, at least, you know, somebody was telling, the Hitler lovers always attack me because I'm not really a big fan of Hitler. There are always a few of them who leave angry comments, you know, on all of my writings wherever I mention Hitler. So I'm ready for you guys. But seriously, though, Gilad, as I look at some of the record, it looks to me like there was a pretty strong and pernicious racism involved in Hitler's thought and in Nazi thought in general.
I definitely agree with you. But whether there was, he definitely saw the Jews as a race, and he had the right to see them as a race, because they definitely see themselves as a race. Now, whether they are a race or not is a completely different question. I don't think that Jews are a race. I believe the Jewish politics and Jewish identity politics is racist. But Jews are not a race. However, they see themselves as a race. They're racially driven.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true of a lot of people. I mean, here in Morocco, the people that speak Moroccan Arabic think of themselves as Arabs. And most of them are not descendants of people from the Arabian Peninsula, but they just speak this local version of the Arabic dialect. But people take these cultural traits and imagine that they're racial.
For sure. So Jews are not a race. They see themselves as a race. Hitler also sees them as a race, because Hitler is a kind of a strictly biological determinist influenced by Darwinist thought. What is interesting is if he saw them as a race, he definitely didn't see them as a Semitic race. As we know, there is no such a thing as a Semitic race. Semitic refers to language and not to a family of languages rather than a race. But where am I leading you here? You know, I always have an agenda. You know, I'm an ex-Jew. Okay. What I'm saying is that when Jews refer to anti-Semitism, it's not because they are Semite. It's because they want through the negative dialectic. By calling you an anti-Semite, for instance, they attributed themselves belonging to the Semitic region, to the Near East, to the Middle East, which they have nothing to do with. So if I'm a Jew and I call you an anti-Semite, I attribute Semitic origin to myself.
But wait a minute, Gilad, wait a minute. This is a little bit like what we were just talking about with now I'm having the missing thoughts here. But seriously, though, isn't it actually the enemies of Jews, that is the anti-Jewish current in European national politics of the late 19th century, that came up with the notion of Jews being Semites, and that was part of this whole racial hierarchy where the white, light-skinned, light-haired people were at the top,
you're right,
and darker people at the bottom.
Anti-Semitism started with Wilhelm Marr in the 80s or 90s of the 19th century, yeah?
Right.
And he coined this term, but it is not clear at all whether he saw it as a biological issue. He saw it really as a clear opposition to the penetration of Jewish culture into Germanic culture.
And now we have the same thing going on with the refugees, the Semitic people of the Middle East coming into Germany.
Now, it's very interesting, because when you look now at anti-Semitism and you accept that it's a dynamic notion. Yes. So first we have Wilhelm Marr that speaks about the infiltration of Jewish ideology into German life. He was actually talking basically about the conflict between Athens and Jerusalem. Now, the next stage, we see the involvement of biological determinism thanks to Darwinism, and then anti-Semitism becomes a racist agenda. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is racially driven, and this is something that pretty much stops or fades after the war. And now, actually, the people who benefit from this tag, this war, or whatever you want to call it, yeah, the anti-Semitism, are the Jewish people, and especially the Zionists, or the people who identify themselves politically. They are, you know, you have heard it before, I'm sure it is in my book with Enzo Apicella, but it's not my invention. You know, we say in the old days, the anti-Semites were the people who hated Jews. Now, anti-Semites are the people the Jews hate. Now, this is very important because they realize that by calling their enemies anti-Semites, they attribute to themselves qualities that they don't own.
That's exactly the point that Ibrahim Sudi makes in We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. He says, I'm a Semite. You know, Je suis Semite is the title of his essay. He's Egyptian, speaks Arabic, so he's a Semite. And he doesn't want to keep allowing the Jews to keep falsely appropriating this category of being Semites.
And it is exactly a false category. And this is why I brought the Mufti. And then you look at Hitler, the anti-Semite, and you realize that he wasn't an anti-Semite. Because he had beer with the Mufti, but Mufti probably had water or orange
coffee
juice
or something. Yeah.
All right. So here is the problem. You know, so we realize that even Hitler, he wasn't an anti-Semite. He was anti-Jewish.
Mm-hmm. But he was even more anti-Slavic, and nobody seems to remember that.
And by the way, he killed many more Slavs than Jews.
He did, and it was even more directly part of his program was to get that Lebensraum by taking the land from the Slavs and pretty much getting rid of them.
Exactly. Yeah. And by the way, the Jews were not at all part of his Lebensraum philosophy. They were not part of his ecological concern. You know, it is a very, very interesting, and this is exactly what we need to ask if we want to make sure that we keep the history, as a revisionist project. We keep the Holocaust as a revisionist project. We can ask these questions. Otherwise, we are left with a religion. Mm-hmm. And the religion is exactly the attempt to seal an historical chapter into total stagnation and to make sure that we reduce few ideas into values. And this is exactly what the definition of Holocaust religion is. You know, it has all the symptoms of organized religion. We have shrines, you know, the Holocaust museums. We have prophets like Bibi Netanyahu. We have clerics like Elie Wiesel, exactly. And we have a God figure. And the God figure in the Holocaust religion is the Jew. The Jew that was about to be eradicated and managed to save oneself without God. And look where he is now. He's running the West, he's running the Middle East, there is the Enon plan, and so on and so on.
Wow. So actually, this is kind of a neo-paganism in a way. It's gotten rid of God. It's got this kind of pagan idol up there to whom new sacrifices must be made.
You know, it's slightly embarrassing, and I don't feel that I should be the one that speak about it, but the Judaic relationship with God is very problematic all the way through. You know, you are a Muslim, you love your God. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we have a very simple, simple and straightforward relationship with God, I think, compared to the Jews and Christians.
Exactly. No, but even Christian is quite simple when it comes to Jews. When it comes to Jews, you don't like your God. How can you like your God? You don't know your God. You know nothing about it. Instead of loving your God, which must be the most natural thing for the believer to do, you prove that you love your God by observing 613 mitzvot. This is a very, very instrumental approach to divinity. Rather than saying Alhamdulillah or thanks God, and you just follow rules that prove that you love God. It's an instrumental relationship. It's very interesting. So for the Jews to drop God is not a big issue, because all they have to do is to adopt some new identifiers. So you drop God and you become a Bolshevik, and instead of having a skull cap or a tzitzis or a kaftan, you have a new symbolic identifiers. And then you drop
Marx is your new gospel.
Yeah, and then you drop Bolshevism and you become LGBT, and you put the earring on the right side, on the right or the left, I don't know.
Yeah, and this is going from tragedy to farce, in my opinion.
You know, this is the issue. So all we have to do is just to adopt new symbolic identifiers. And this is why, for instance, even when it comes to Jewish solidarity with Palestine, they've never saved a single Palestinian. What we have instead is a lot of identifiers. You know, they always have the badges and the scarves and the hats and so on. But it's just to show that they don't follow God, that they're on their new God. It's like symbolic spiel.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, we've just about hit the end of the hour. So let's bring it back to the Arthur Topham trial. Arthur's on trial for making people think by taking this the Germany Must Die piece of genocide propaganda from World War II and substituting, you know, Israel and Jews for Germany and Germans or Nazis or whatever. So you think Arthur's very likely to win this thing?
I don't know. I'm not a prophet. I cannot say whether
you're a heck of a musician, though.
I cannot say whether they find him innocent, which is more than possible. I'm totally convinced that they are not going to send him to jail. You know, you need a unanimous 12 people. 12 juries to agree on that. But I think that the entire court case is a farce. I've been there. I'm definitely an expert on this topic. The Crown had very little to say. She couldn't even establish what hate is along the entire trial. She didn't manage to say what is it that is accused of.
Well, it sounds like we're in Kafka land here, but you know we're going to have to leave it there, Gilad, because we've hit the end of the hour. So thank you for your amazing work.
Great to talk to you, man.
Can't wait to see you next time you come through Madison, Wisconsin, or wherever we cross paths.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. When are you back?
I'll be back very, very soon, like mid-November. This coming week, I'll be flying back from Morocco to the U.S. by way of Paris, assuming that they don't mess with me in Paris because of some of the stuff I've been doing lately.
All right. Okay. Anyway, keep safe, and both of you, and have a safe journey, man.
Okay. Thanks,
Ewan. Yeah, man. Bye-bye.
Bye.